Russia's invasion of Ukraine has driven up the cost of staple foods. Wheat and corn prices have reached record highs. Developing nations are already feeling the pain. So is global food security at risk? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Foliba Thibault. Russia's war on Ukraine has created fears of a global food crisis. The two countries supply a third of the world's wheat and are major exporters of barley, corn and sunflower oil. Fighting has disrupted exports, and that's led to record prices on international markets. The cost of wheat is at its highest level in 14 years. Corn is at a nine-year high. Ukraine's ports stopped working when Russia began its invasion last week. This means grain stocks from both countries aren't reaching their main markets in the Middle East and Africa. Economists say consumers, particularly in lower and middle-income countries, will have to pay higher prices. Well, let's take a look at how much some countries rely on Russia and Ukraine's wheat. Many of them are already battling food shortages. Egypt is the world's biggest importer of wheat. It gets 85% of it from Russia and Ukraine. The two nations also supply war-ravaged Yemen with 40%. And Ukraine's wheat makes up around half of Lebanon's needs. The country is still recovering from the Beirut port blast in 2020 that destroyed its main grain silo.
If the situation escalates and the wheat market is halted, we have enough for about a month's worth of wheat stored in mills. But after that, we have no reserves.
With war in Ukraine and Russia, our reserves will drop, and instead of supporting our needs for the next 4 years, it will only be available for 2 or 3 months. The crisis will affect us and we will suffer from wheat shortages.
Because of the war between Russia and Ukraine, we have fears of a shortage of flour and wheat. But God willing, we will overcome these difficulties.
Well, let's bring in our guest now. In Beirut, we have Patrick Mardini, an economist at Leadenhall International for Market Solutions. He's also the president of the Lebanese Institute for Market Studies. In Washington, D.C., David Laborde, a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. And in London, Dara McDowell, a geopolitical risk consultant specializing in Russia and the Caucasus. A warm welcome to you all, gentlemen. Thank you very much for being on Inside Story. Patrick, in Beirut, let me start with you. Lebanon, of course, relies heavily on wheat from Ukraine. It's already facing a very bad economic crisis. Tell us about the situation right now. How worse could it get? And what's the knock-on effect of the war in Ukraine on Lebanon?
Sure. So Lebanon, as you said, imports most of the wheat from Ukraine. The disruption in the Azov Sea and in the Black Sea are actually impacting the delivery of wheat that have been already bought. So you have those supply chain problems. The ships are being delayed. Mm-hmm. And the importers are now looking for alternative from Argentina, USA, and probably Canada for in case you have longer war and more disruptions. So basically, if you are going to import this wheat from alternative places, the prices will be higher. Mm-hmm. You need to transport them through a longer route, so it's more expensive. And now, with the war increasing the fuel prices worldwide, the transportation cost will be even higher.
Right.
So actually, we will have a problem in Lebanon with the prices of wheat going up.
Yeah, the economy minister has said there's a month worth of wheat reserves left. How will the Lebanese government respond, do you think?
So that's a big problem because the main silo that stores wheat has been destroyed during the port explosion of Beirut. And indeed, now we rely on small storage facilities in small mills across Lebanon, which can only last for 1 month. Now, the Ministry of Economy fixes the prices of wheat. Mm-hmm. If they will keep if they will keep the price of bread low, and the price of importing wheat will be higher, the cost of importing wheat will be higher than the price, then we might have serious shortages. Right. So the ministry should be courageous and increase the prices in order to allow covering the higher cost, or else we might end up with...
But an increase in prices is not good for the Lebanese people, is it? I mean, they're already facing severe economic issues.
Absolutely. I mean, Lebanon is going through one of the harshest crises ever. We had a massive devaluation of the currency, which made the purchasing power of the population shrink. So now they can buy way less with the same wage. And with the increase of prices of wheat, it will increase poverty. Poverty jumped to like 80% of the population. 80 to 85% of the population is expected to be under poverty line now. And those expectations will be higher in case we had either shortage of wheat or higher prices of wheat. Right. Now, the other dimension is that the central bank subsidizes wheat and is losing the dollar reserve on that. I don't know how much he could drain those reserves anymore.
Okay, Patrick, let me bring in David into the conversation, and we'll further talk about this region and Lebanon and other countries that are heavily reliant on wheat from Ukraine and Russia. David, we are now into the second week of this conflict in Ukraine, and wheat prices have already gone up. Do you expect them to go up as much as 50%, as some people are predicting? And what will that mean for countries in parts of the Middle East and Africa that are very vulnerable to the price of wheat?
So let's start by saying that even before the crisis, all the prices of these commodities were pretty high. So it's not like if we have increased by 50% already from low level. So, and that for the global food security, we have to keep this into account. Before the crisis, we were already in a very potentially gloomy situation with also some bad harvests coming from Latin America. So the markets were worried and tense. And now, of course, you create this disruption where basically one third or a bit more of the wheat that is globally traded is basically hostage of the situation. The only kind of good news is we are dealing with the last harvest. So there were just, you know, one third of the remaining harvest to be shipped from Russia and Ukraine. But of course, for some countries like Lebanon, Egypt, we talk in the previous segment, you talk about Yemen that import wheat through the WFP also, but up to Pakistan and Tunisia going west, all this region is dependent on this supply on a regular basis. So that's a major source of tension. Now, also what we have to keep in mind is this is a situation today. Tomorrow, countries are planting, of course, new crops, but they need fertilizer.
Right.
And here also, we have a specific issue that can put pressure on the next harvest.
Indeed, yes. I will get to that about the fertilizer issue because of the sanctions imposed on Russia. I just want to bring in Dara to the conversation to get your initial thoughts, Dara. I mean, most grain flows out of Odessa and other Western ports on the Black Sea. And we don't have a clear picture yet of the extent of the damage on port facilities and railroads. But what will be, in your opinion, the short-term and long-term consequences, Dara, on Ukraine's capacity to move its crop production beyond its borders?
Well, it's going to be extremely bad at the moment. What we're seeing is Russian forces have taken a lot of the southern coast of Ukraine. That's where their advance has had the most success. And if you get to a situation where most of Ukraine's Black Sea ports are effectively under an occupation regime, even if you can get the grain to those facilities, you know, there's a question legally as to whether it can be exported from there.
Right.
This is before we get to the fact that the war itself is depleting Ukraine's capacity to produce grain this season, both due to direct damage and due to the diversion of manpower.
And just to clarify, because we've heard about the sanctions, of course, are the sanctions imposed on Russia, Dara, are they already impacting third parties, countries that are reliant on Russian exports? Are food and fertilizer exports, for example, being allowed to continue?
Well, the sanctions aren't directly affecting those. There have been numerous carve-outs within the sanctions regime for certain commodity exports, food included. The question will be what Russia itself decides to do. The Kremlin is very aware that inflation can be a potent political tool to put pressure on the countries that are supporting Ukraine. We've already seen Joseph Biden in most of his addresses has made inflation and preventing inflation due to the sanctions hitting American consumers a key talking point. It's not clear that that's within his gift, however, when it comes to food. Russia, even before this war, had reduced its export quota for the year ahead, fearing the potential rise in domestic prices. We've also seen, it's a very good point on fertilizers. Russia and Belarus produce a huge amount of the world's potash, and they're already talking about restrictions on that. Equally, natural gas is one of the precursor components for a lot of chemical fertilizers. So we could be in a position where Russia is still able to produce quite a lot of food. Mm-hmm. It's restricting how and where it exports it. And it's also restricting the components for fertilizers that are needed for other countries to grow food. And this creates a pretty powerful inflationary pressure in an economic situation where we're already seeing pretty high levels of global inflation due to the emergence from the pandemic. And that's put pressure on the political leaders who are currently supporting Ukraine.
So, David, Dara says, Russia could use this as a pressure tool, but the Russians also are under a great deal of pressure with these sanctions. Is there any way that Russian producers can circumvent these sanctions, perhaps through China, for example?
So clearly, I think that the Chinese market can be a key source of opportunities for Russian producers. Just during the Olympic Games, for instance, China has accepted to lower their, if you want, sanitary standard on some shipment to receive more grain from Russia that previously were banned from the markets. Still, what's going to happen in the Black Sea and shipping grains from the western part of Russia to China is going to be obviously costly. And there are some limits to that. Mm-hmm. The recent government has its own way to control what exporters are doing. So it's not like if it is really a market economy where people will try to find own markets on their own.
Right. So we talked about the fertilizers. How are people going to get the fertilizer they need to grow more food if they're not getting it from Russia, David?
So, we have different kinds of fertilizers. Some can be manufactured from natural gas or coal. And here, of course, the supply of natural gas and coal is an issue, or the price can be an issue. And then you have some fertilizer like potash and phosphate that are mined from deposits. And these deposits are not available everywhere on Earth. So we are going to see the production that can potentially increase from places like Canada. Germany have their own potash deposit. So, mm-hmm. But still, we are going to see very high price, meaning that the wealthy farmers, and basically the farmers from the US, from Europe, are going to be able to afford it, even if the cost of production will go up, and of course the cost of the grains they produce will go up. But in other parts of the world, that's where we can see really shortage.
Right.
We have some government that subsidize fertilizer, and I think that will be the same discussion that we had earlier about how long government can really subsidize inputs without becoming bankrupt. Mm-hmm. But in other places, in particular in Africa, we can see shortage with lower production when we start from situation where actually they don't use enough fertilizer in this part of the world and their yield are already very low, and that can be very a big issue.
Speaking of subsidies, Patrick in Beirut, let's talk about this region, and I want to talk about Egypt in particular. The Egyptian government hasn't stopped yet its subsidies of bread, even though there are reports that it might do so. With the current situation, this could mean a lot of trouble for the Egyptian government, right? They could lose out fiscally. Do you see perhaps other countries in this region, Saudi Arabia, for example, with money from the high oil prices, stepping in to help countries like Egypt or even Lebanon to help them subsidize food?
So indeed, the last time we had a big increase in food prices, specifically in the price of bread, it went hand in hand with the Arab Spring, right? Mm-hmm. With this unrest. And so there is this constant fear where basically the normal thing to do is to let the price of bread go up because the price of wheat went up, but then you are afraid of those social tensions. I think Egypt is trying to work with the their international partners, the USA, the IMF, and probably the GCC countries, in order to basically be able to maintain the higher cost of subsidies, because the higher the wheat price, the higher the cost of the subsidy will be. And I think they would be able to do that. They have also been accumulating good foreign exchange reserve, which would give them more margin of maneuver. I think Lebanon, on the other hand, is in a biggest problem. I mean, the situation is catastrophic. The central bank has been draining the foreign exchange reserve massively for the past 2 years. We are at alarming level. And the central bank has been using those foreign exchange reserve to do two things, to try to anchor the exchange rate at around 20,000 Lebanese pounds by losing dollars, and for subsidizing wheat imports, right? So those are the two sources draining Lebanon's foreign exchange reserves.
Right.
And we already got to the point where we cannot use them anymore. So now we have a big problem.
Patrick, what about Yemen? I mean, the WFP was already forced to reduce food rations to Yemen for 8 million people in Yemen. What impact will the escalation in the conflict in Ukraine have on food aid in Yemen and other places that are in conflict in this region?
But I think your other guests are better positioned to answer this question. From my perspective, I would say that, one, it will depend on the budget that the World Food Program is willing to allocate to Yemen. And two, it will depend on supply chain issues related to the sources of this wheat, where it will come from, and how much time it will take to get there.
All right. Well, let's pause a moment, gentlemen, and take a look at how pressure on food supplies in the past has led to protests and political upheaval, something Patrick alluded to earlier. In Egypt, for example, bread is a staple in every meal. Cost increases and shortages triggered the bread riots in 1977 and fueled the protest movement that toppled President Hosni Mubarak in 2011. Tunisia's bread riots of the 1980s killed more than 100 people. Fears of a repeat have been simmering ever since. And protests in Sudan against the cost of bread and fuel eventually led to the removal of longtime President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. Dara, let me ask you about this. In lower and middle income countries like Egypt, Tunisia and Sudan, we've seen unrest in the past when you know, the government brought up the price of bread or flour. Are we looking at possible unrest now in other countries, in even Russia, perhaps, if prices keep going up?
Well, it's less likely in Russia simply because Russia is producing a lot of this grain, and the state has huge direct and indirect control over the economy. Mm-hmm. So it can subsidize those prices, and it can keep prices at a certain low level if it wants to. I would expect that the Kremlin will do that if it sees rising bread prices as any sort of threat. Vladimir Putin has been talking a lot about the Bolsheviks recently, and it was the bread riots in 1917 that overthrew the Tsar and helped bring them onto power. So you're quite right that, you know, this is a staple. This is not a this is an obligatory commodity. You know, people do need to eat. What will be interesting going forward is to see whether Russia can use its export reserves as a tool of influence. We've seen during this crisis that Russia has not only faced a kind of coalition of the West, or say the usual suspects in support of Ukraine, but has faced a wide range of countries that would normally be a little bit more sympathetic to its position, either abstaining or voting against it in international fora like the UN. So, you know, providing grain to countries that are under duress or regimes where, you know, the government may become destabilized due to rises in grain prices, maybe a way for Russia to win friends and influence people,
right,
assuming it can get the grain to them.
Right. Patrick, your thoughts about what this could lead to, possibly? I mean, could this lead to unrest in the Middle East, North Africa region if prices are going up and keep going up?
I think that there is high risks of unrest, especially that we've been in a high inflation framework for a while. With COVID, of course, we need to separate in the Middle East between oil exporting nations and oil importing. I don't think that oil and gas exporting nations would have any problem per se. I think that the problem is with the other countries, those countries who might have some social unrest related to the high prices. We're already in a high prices environment. And now with this shock, I think prices will be higher. In Lebanon, we had massive demonstration in the past 2 years. They were protesting corruption. And we are heading to an election within like a couple of months. So it's like the worst timing for the political class, I think, to run elections.
Right.
And if they think about to split, then, you know, you would have massive disruption and massive protest.
David, this war in Ukraine today poses a serious risk to global food security. What should be the response from governments, in your view, and international organizations?
So obviously, one of the responses is to use money. We just see it, you know, some of the oil exporter countries can actually mobilize some of their financial resources to support some government that will have to implement social safety net to protect their population, at least in the middle of this crisis. But also, as we just discussed, WFP, the World Food Programs, when the cost of food doubles, their budget doesn't double automatically. Mm-hmm. So basically, their purchasing power is divided by two. So we also need to help them. And now I think there is additional measure that have to be taken. First, solidarity also on this commodity market. We don't want to see a domino effect of export restriction or export ban that will just amplify the issue. So the last thing that the world needs is tomorrow that India say, in order to fight food inflation, I am also restricting my my exports. Argentina is also a key player that in many cases, due to social unrest at home and food inflation, tend to put this export limit, but it just makes the world market smaller and smaller, and people start to panic and buy more and more. And so you see really this spiraling situation as we have seen in 2007, 2008. So, you know, this coordination and try to show solidarity, not right. only in terms of money, but also in terms of commodity. Last but not least, today we have also large, just one example of the bad policy that can exist today, we have large biofuel programs that consume a large share of grains, but also vegetable oil. And I just want to point that the vegetable oil market is also in turmoil, and it's a staple food for many people, in particular when we move more in Western Asia and East Asia.
Yeah.
And you know how we can basically reduce the pressure, reduce the demand on what is non-essential, because feeding people is essential.
Right.
And that can be kind of response, you know. And okay. of course, there is more medium-term thinking.
Right. Dara in London, let me get your thoughts on this. You know, what should governments and international organizations do? And what are some of the measures that importing countries could take to mitigate the drop in supply?
With everything that David just said there, it's not clear what importing countries can do without the cooperation and collaboration of exporting countries and with international financial support to get food to people at a reasonable price. You know, if we're going to cushion the impact of the markets on the final consumers. The question that I would have is whether governments around the globe have the bandwidth and the capacity to do this. The EU and the US are already quite engaged with the Ukraine crisis. They're kind of fighting that fire right now. The US will probably still have half an eye on its Indo-Pacific strategy and potential challenges from China. And the kind of programs that David was talking about would require a pretty global multilateral response to ensure that fertilizers, that grain, that everything is shipped worldwide to where it's needed at a reasonable price. And so it's a coordination issue and something that, you know, the globe hasn't been extremely good at doing in the past, but we'll see what happens as this conflict goes on. You know, whether we get to a point where the actual fighting in Ukraine is terminated quite quickly and can go on to mitigating its effects, including on global markets. But right now, I would say it's difficult to see that actually happening.
Well, thank you to all of our guests, Patrick Mardini, David Laborde and Dara McDowell. And thank you for watching. You can watch this program again anytime by visiting our website at aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We are at AJInsideStory. From me, Fully Batibo, and the whole team, thanks for watching. Bye for now.